Welcome to the VA Tourism Podcast, and I'm Coach Benton Williams. VA Tourism Podcast is dedicated to Africa's travel and tourism industry, where leaders from the private and public sectors get to talk to us. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn, and Google Podcasts. The coronavirus pandemic has caused unprecedented levels of discomfort for many travelers and tourists in the last 12 months. As devastating that this may be, it has actually heightened the call for the protection of tourists in an emergency situation. The World Tourism Organization, with the active participation of over 90 of its members, has begun the process of developing an international code for the protection of tourists. The legal counsel, Alicia Gomez, will help us understand the details of the document. Alicia has over 15 years' experience in the UN system and has been the head of the legal unit of the Madrid-based organization since 2017. Welcome to the VA Tourism Podcast. And my guest today is Ms. Alicia Gomez, who is the World Tourism Organization, UNWTO's legal counsel. And she's led a lot of processes. She's had 15 years of experience in the UN system and 10 years at UNWTO. And today's conversation is about the International Code for the Protection of Tourists that is being developed by UNWTO and other partners. Alicia, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Kojo. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you very much for having me with you today.
Okay. Now, let's just go straight to that. What informed the promulgation of this international code for tourists, for the protection of tourists?
Well, actually, the member states of UNWTO and the UNWTO governing bodies have been discussing for the last 10 years the need to develop an instrument that would harmonize tourism consumer standards at the international level. In fact, despite tourism being such a global phenomenon, the reality is that national legislations, perhaps with the exception of the European Union, are very different when it comes to issues related to the protection of tourists and their consumer rights. And then COVID-19 happened, and we have all seen how these disparities have created a big level of uncertainty and how the lack of coordination affected millions of tourists that were stranded abroad at the worst of the crisis last year. So travelers do not know anymore what are their rights, who is responsible in case of a cancellation, or if they get stranded abroad because of COVID-19. The questions keep multiplying themselves if you have to book a travel abroad, and it doesn't help that the answers are so different from a company to another, from a country to another. At the same time, there are new safety and security protocols, and these are imposing new obligations to tourists without clarity as to what are their rights. And as we know, as far as we know, this situation will likely continue for some time until we, are able to contain the virus. So in this scenario, how can we restore tourist trust and confidence to effectively restart tourism? Because without tourists, there is no tourism. So the development of an international code for the protection of tourists is an initiative that is motivated by the need to clarify the rights of tourists and the obligations of all tourism stakeholders, and to set minimum standards at the international level so that tourists, regardless of their nationality, the country of destination they choose, and the nationality of the tourism service provider, know what to expect if something goes wrong after booking the trip, during the trip itself, and most generally, what are the minimum rights they are entitled to as consumers. So with these in mind, the Executive Council of UNWTO established an intergovernmental committee to develop this code as one of the pillars that will promote recovery and one of the very needed documents for the COVID-19 world, but also for the post-COVID-19 world.
How binding will this document be?
So this is actually an excellent question, Kocho. I might not have a reply right now because it will actually depend on the level of political commitment that we achieve. The Executive Council left the question quite open and requested the committee to make a recommendation on this. And the committee has decided to leave this discussion on the legal nature of the code for the very end of the process, once the content of the code has been developed and they have a better understanding of what would be the legal commitments they will need to undertake. So for us, this is good because we're not losing any time to develop content. So content is our focus and content is what is urgently needed. But also because this is a decision in which there might be some division and controversy. So we think it is better that we take it at the end of the process. Once we have developed the content and countries see how useful it would actually be to have this document becoming legally binding. So right now we're working on the idea that we build a code to which countries would be able to adhere on a voluntary basis, and which implementation could be monitored by UNWTO. This would not be a legally enforceable document, but politically speaking, it would commit member states. And through the General Assembly, the countries having adhered to the code would be called and reminded of their commitment to it. At the same time, some countries are already discussing the possibility to convert this code into an international convention, I mean, a legally binding instrument that would be enforceable for the countries that ratify it. And of course, this would give a more stronger impact to the code. But we need to bear in mind that negotiating and concluding a convention takes time. And, you know, the content of this code is needed as of yesterday. So we started with the code idea because it's a more agile approach, and it enables us to develop content faster. And we hope that it will be adhered to by many countries so that this could bring it to the next step of becoming a legally enforceable document quite quickly. But as I said at the beginning, it will all depend on the buy-in of member states. We believe at this point in time that the importance here is that this code becomes a useful legal framework that is generally accepted so that countries wish to commit to it and implement it because they realize the impact that it will have in restoring tourists' confidence.
I know you've given a bit of a background, you know, to this, but can you give me the specific, you know, considerations that the committee, you know, took into consideration in arriving at this set of rules and code?
Mm-hmm. So, well, right now the committee is finalizing chapter one of the code that is dedicated to the assistance to tourists in emergency situations, to effectively protect tourists when stranded abroad because of a force majeure situation. So now it's COVID-19, but it could be, you know, the future tsunami, an earthquake, a terrorist attack, any other situation. In all of the construction of the code, the committee is always considering very carefully, trying to achieve a fair balance of responsibilities among all the tourism stakeholders that are involved whenever an emergency situation occurs. So this chapter concretely, and then more chapters will come, but this chapter concretely on the assistance to tourists in emergency situations is very much aimed at covering all the insufficiencies that we have observed during the COVID-19 crisis. And so in my opinion, the three main factors that have been considered for this chapter in particular are first of all, a bigger attribution of responsibility to the host countries. In this sense, for example, the provisions of chapter one highlight the role and the responsibilities of the host country so that even if, for example, the assistance or repatriation in an emergency situation are included in the contract with a tourism service provider or with a travel insurance, and sometimes they typically are the responsibility of the tourism service provider or of the travel insurance, the reality is that there may be situations in which the host country is uniquely placed to actually provide this assistance or repatriation. So the provisions are requesting that the host country does so in those situations without, you know, prejudice to its subsequent right to seek redress, but not to leave tourists in a situation of neglect. And also at the same time, while we, you know, are seeing that in most of the legislations, travel contracts typically stipulate that the tourism service provider is responsible for providing assistance. What these provisions are saying now is that the host country also has a responsibility in enabling, facilitating, and ensuring that tourism service providers can effectively address these responsibilities. Because as we've seen with COVID-19, for instance, tourism service providers might not always have the means to effectively address these responsibilities because of the magnitude of the crisis.
Okay. Tell us more about the composition of the committee, its membership.
Yes, so we currently have 103 countries in the committee. This is a very, very large group. 31 are from Africa. The largest representation in terms of regions, I mean, we have countries from all the regions of the world, but definitely the largest representation in terms of regions is Africa and Europe. We also have international organizations such as the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, International Civil Aviation Organization, International Standard Organization, associations that represent the private sector, hospitality, airlines. We have IATA, we have ECTA, we have HOTREG. We also have established a mechanism to receive the consolidated input of the more than 500 UNWTO affiliate members from the private sector. So this is by far the largest public-private sector group that is currently sitting and agreeing on a common approach and harmonized standards for the present and future of tourism consumer standards. So this level of engagement is definitely unprecedented, but we think it's a great indicator of the political will existing at the moment around this initiative.
Okay. And if you look at the commitment level, at what level are you expecting member states to, embrace this new code?
Yes,
I know it's
not
binding to the national thing, but what is your expectations in terms of the commitment?
Well, we are expecting that as we progressively develop this code, member states start integrating these provisions in their national system and taking all the necessary measures so that the code is fully implemented in their countries. We hope that the code will be approved by UNWTO's General Assembly that will take place in Marrakesh in Morocco in October of this year, and that the member states will then adhere to the code, commit to its implementation, and agree to a system of monitoring by UNWTO so that we can effectively measure that they are complying with its provisions. This is not necessary, for the organization. This is necessary for the countries themselves if they wish to provide guarantees to tourists and ensure that tourists are not afraid to travel to their countries, at least not because of the fear of not being appropriately protected or taken care of.
Okay. But again, in terms of the when this will come into effect, do you have some dates in mind?
Yes. Of course, once the code is approved by the General Assembly in October, then it would become fully operational. The General Assembly would endorse it, and then the countries will be able to adhere to it and start implementing it. However, we will start publishing on an interim basis the results of the deliberations of the committee. So, for instance, we will be publishing now Chapter 1 on the assistance to tourists in emergency situations once it is finalized, hopefully on the 17th of March. So that countries can already use the content, because the content is needed right now, and this is such a large and representative group that we believe that countries may wish to use already what we have developed as it is being produced and progressively implemented in their respective countries.
Back to the tourists and the traveler. When does he or she, have access to this? And if he or she is caught in a situation, in any emergency or something, how then can the person assess or, get some help with this document?
Well, this is still to be developed, the exact mechanism for implementation and then monitoring. But the idea is that this code, countries that adhere to this code will, state so. So they will have implement this code in their respective countries. And so whenever tourists is in one of these situations, they would be able to go to the national authorities and say, well, you see, this is what the code says. So this is the guarantee that I am expecting. And if this doesn't happen, then they would be able to, notify UNWTO, and UNWTO would be monitoring that the code is being effectively implemented. At the same time, I have to tell you that many of the, for example, in the assistance to tourists in emergency situations, what we are including in the code is many provisions regarding prevention mechanisms. So it's not only that countries have to take certain measures when a situation occurs, but for example, we are requesting countries that adhere to the code to set up permanent structures that will be there to set up training materials, for instance, for tourism service stakeholders, to set up coordination mechanisms with tourism service stakeholders for whenever an emergency occurs, so that the country is ready to actually implement the code once, an emergency occurs.
Okay, excellent. As we wrap up our conversation, I wanted to digress a bit on the, framework of tourism ethics. What has been the response, and what was the feedback as a person who was very much involved in that process?
Yes, well, as you know, the code, actually, the Framework Convention on Tourism Ethics started with a code. The code, UNWTO's code for tourism ethics, and the code was converted into a legally binding instrument, into an international convention by our General Assembly in 2019. So after it was converted into international convention, we opened the signature part for the convention. And we have only one country that has signed the convention. This is Indonesia. It doesn't mean that the other countries are not implementing it. I mean, our surveys have revealed that, in fact, almost half of the member states of the organization are implementing, the provisions of the code, and the code is generally accepted, and so is the convention. But as to become, legally binding, that's a different procedure. It takes time in the countries. It has to go through the parliament or other, other approval systems. So we need 10 countries to ratify the convention in order for the convention to enter into force. Right now, none of our member states have ratified the convention. And so this is where with, the code for the protection of tourists, we are seeing that it is perhaps much more useful to have a code than a convention, because a convention takes a lot of time to enter into force. So we, let's say that it may seem, this may seem a lot of time for anyone listening to us, but actually in the world of multilateral treaties, this is a normal pace for, having conventions enter into force. It's a long process.
Alicia, what would be your final words to the tourism community?
Well, I would say that we are working, for example, this initiative, the code is perhaps not the, priority initiative right now, because the priority initiative right now is, safety and security protocols. But this is yet another pillar. This is complementary to what is being done in that field. So I think there is much to be done in many different fields. And while, the priority is focused right now on safety and security protocols, I think that we can all, bring our contributions in other areas that are complementary to that work that is being done. I also think, and I join here our Secretary General in saying that this is a global problem. So definitely what we need is to be able to sit together and to agree on a common approach and on a common solution So this initiative, for example, is interesting in this sense because, you know, there are so many countries in the committee and they are sitting together and they are agreeing to a text, which proves that we can definitely, you know, come out of this in a coordinated manner. So this is my, you know, my message is to try to come up with common approaches and harmonize and you know, come up with global solutions, not just look at one country on its own.
Alisa Gomez, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Kojo, for giving visibility to this initiative and for giving me the space today for presenting this. Thank you so much. Thank you so much.